The House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we're going to change the agenda some. We're going to have possible work sessions on 2163 and 2355 before we do the senior and elder abuse. So I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2163.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2163 has no revenue impact, and there was a fiscal impact that was issued. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It requires the Oregon State Lottery to adopt a comprehensive policy that minimizes the risks and harms associated with lottery games and mandates the director of the Oregon State Lottery to employ a person to advise the Oregon State Lottery Commission on addiction and mental health concerns related to playing lottery games. And there is a dash one amendment that's on this one.
Great. Harrison Conley, could you come up, because this is the bill that you changed completely, right? Am I right?
Well, I think...
No, I've got the wrong bill. So, okay, so I would like Jeff Murata to come up. Oh, Larry, you also had signed up to speak. Would you like to come up too? So, colleagues, we changed with the amendment, and so we've given you engrossed amendment on 2163, and what you can see that the print is different. The larger print is what the amendment is. Why don't you look at it and see if you can ascertain what it is. I highlighted mine, so on the first page it would be sort of the regenerated 1-4, and on the second page it would be up at the top, line 7-15, and on after that, lines 16 and 17, and then lines 19 through 22, and all of page 3. And this is a suggestion by Jeff Murata. Have you had a chance to see this, Mr. Nicewander?
Briefly, yes. They just handed it to me.
Okay. Well, since you had signed up to speak earlier, would you like to speak on the original bill?
Chair and committee members, that would be my preference, but I could also, after a few minutes of reading it while Jeff testifies, I could maybe comment on dash one.
That's
in a few
great.
Minutes.
Perfect.
All right. Committee members and Chair, for the record, my name is Larry Nicewander. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery. Coming back to talk to you about House Bill 2163, it was originally introduced. To be clear about upfront again, lottery has not taken a position on this bill as of today. We're just here to provide you with some historically relevant information, some policy considerations, and then address any questions you may have. The bill, I believe in either version, would call for an amendment to the lottery's mission. So in the original bill as introduced, it would require the lottery to actively balance its mission to maximize revenue while minimizing the impact of addictive play of lottery games. So any change to the mission, which has been in place since both measures that established the lottery, which were both passed by voter initiative in 1984, any change to that, there's not been any change to that since it passed. So changes to it are ones that lottery would want to have some considerable deliberation on amongst the committee as to what it means, and you'll hear that in my testimony, being clear about what things differently you want the lottery to do, or what new things you want the lottery to do as a result of that. Those language changes. The idea of mitigating harms, preventing problem gambling issues and things of that nature raises a significant policy issue and sort of a legal issue. And as the chair and many of you probably know, I have asked for and hope to soon receive some legal advice that will help guide the lottery and this policy committee on what things are clearly within the lottery's authority to do within its operating budget, and which things this committee and this bill could direct the lottery to do by statute. And if passed, if it didn't conflict inherently with the constitutional provisions, the lottery would carry on those activities. What would hang in the balance a little bit, depending on the legal analysis, is whether certain activities could in fact be paid for out of the lottery's operating budget or whether an alternative funding source would be necessary to fund those activities if the lottery were charged by law to do them. So I hope to come back when I have that opinion and share that. I've asked for it. I've told the Department of Justice that when I get it, it will be immediately made available for public review and consideration, and I expect that this committee may want some explanation of that once it's available to help it with its deliberations. So, to the bill. So, the language in the bill, page section 2 of page 1, lines 22 and 23, starts to talk about the requirement that the lottery adopt a comprehensive policy to minimize the risks and mitigate the harms. And so, as I mentioned earlier, having some deliberation about what that means would be really helpful to the lottery. What new things is it required to do? What is the desired outcome? Want to be careful about other jurisdictions have had language put into their statutes that have in effect stood up a legal term called a statutory duty of care. We want to be real careful about that in that if you set up something that requires the lottery to absolutely prevent anybody from having problem gambling and then somebody does have it, then there could be legal arguments raised about whether there's some exposure, if you will, to the state for failing to fulfill its statutory duty of care. So we want to be careful about what the requirement is. Self-exclusion programs, things that the person maintains personal responsibility for, those things probably don't pose such a risk. But if it's, in fact, the state or the retailer's obligation to ensure certain things don't happen, that's something that we really want to be careful around. In terms of terms under this policy, and I just want to, you know, again, which is where deliberation that this committee can have would really help the lottery if it's asked to implement this. They're new terms, they're new phrases, and they probably have some meaning. And I know that in previous testimony before the committee, there's been conversations about what other jurisdictions have done, whether it's been in Australia or other locations, and things that they've done to effectively mitigate harms. And some of these phrases probably come from some of those other jurisdictions and other studies. And so they have meaning, and I guess it would be good to bring that meaning here. What does it mean to have a code of conduct for marketing and promoting Oregon Lottery products? What does it mean to have strategies to enhance personal responsibility? What does it have to have strategies to minimize the risks and mitigate the harms? What does it mean to have institutional structures to protect persons who struggle with mental health and addiction issues? Those are significant terms, and I believe they do have some meaning in other jurisdictions, and I guess I'd want to just make sure we have some discussion around that. If strategies means changing machine design, if strategies means having periods of machine downtime, changes to the rates of repeat bets that games can do, if it means having binding play pre-commitments where a machine turns off, if there are time and money limits placed on bets, if there are shutdown times, reductions to certain features amongst the games that would change what lottery could offer versus, say, one of the 9 tribal casinos. If that's the intent, it'd just be clear to know what those strategies are or institutional structures are, because we'd have to take that into consideration as we look at how would it affect operations, how would it affect costs, and potentially how it would affect revenue. It's very possible, too, and I'll know more when I get this legal advice, if the lottery were compelled to do some things differently to modify games and features and activities, and those things had costs, and they were being done to mitigate harms, and efforts to mitigate harms were to fall outside of what lottery can spend money on, then costs associated with making those changes could also have to have an alternative funding source. That's just a possibility that I want to mention today. So the bill in its original form required lottery to employ an individual with an appropriate education and experience to evaluate the effects of lottery operations and the effects of games on those who might struggle with mental health and addiction issues. So that's clear on its face what that would be required to do. What's not so clear is what would the individual do with the results of those evaluations. So, you know, what would be the desired outcome of that input? Again, does it drive to certain changes? If that's the intent, I just want to understand that as the director, because implementing it will be clearer by those discussions. And, you know, so, you know, to the extent that it's to reduce play, consumer play or have less play, or to target those that may have risks of having problem gambling. You're aware of the revenue source and the stream, and so, you know, we want to make sure that it hits the target, but probably doesn't have adverse effects on the revenue stream, as every 1% reduction is about $11 million per biennium to the support for state programs and services. The bill you mentioned, mentioned in the opening comments that it doesn't have a revenue impact, at least none noted at this time. There are possibilities there, and I just want to mention it just because I don't think it's an intended consequence, but if there's anything that does drive to an impact that reduces sales, then any reduction in sales or revenue generated does have a corresponding effect on bond rating, bond capacity, and ability to pay debt service. So it just depends on what the desired effect is once this bill was in place. And then I guess I would just leave you with, continue to take the charge that's in our mission. It's a dual mission: maximize revenue commensurate with the public good very seriously. And in my testimony, which I believe Regina was able to provide you, I do on page 5 talk about various activities that the lottery does carry out, continues to carry out, and as long as I have any ability to influence them, we'll continue to carry them out to carry out that part of our mission, whether it relates to advertising, the provisions in our retail contract, what we do at our website that links to responsible gambling, the messaging we do, the utilization of work groups to guide policy, the solicitation of public input and public testimony, and the collaborative efforts with the Oregon Health Authority, the Problem Gambling Council, the Liquor Control Commission, and the Child Support Division. So those things are, I just want you to know, regardless of the outcome of this bill, those things are going to continue. And we'll work to minimize the administrative costs impact so that we can continue to meet the expectations for revenue production. So with that, I think I will hope that some of those questions could be asked and answered, and I will come back and provide more information on the legal aspects of this when I have that information.
Great.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions unless you want to hear from Mr. Murata.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Larry, I'm just curious. Okay, so you'll have additional information when?
Well, I would love to be able to make a promise to you that I'll have it next week or the week after, but if I don't get it by the end of next week, I'm going to be gone part of next week, just so you know, on a business trip that will take me out of the area for the first couple of days. If I don't have it by the end of next week, I will report back on what I know at the end of next week.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Nyslander? Thank you so much, Larry. Okay, Jeff, so you are the person who had suggested the amendment to this bill. So could you talk with us about that, please?
Madam Chair, Tomei, representatives, I am, for the record, Jeff Murata with Problem Gambling Solutions. I had recommended several changes to this bill. Primarily what those recommendations did was to broaden some of the language around what do we mean by minimizing harm. It was the bill in its original language mainly addressed those who were playing lottery games in an addictive fashion, and there was also reference to individuals with other mental health issues and helping to protect those vulnerable groups. The proposed language or amendments broadened that to include different aspects of the way the public could benefit through additional protections. For instance, there needs to be included in this, the phrasing needs to be protections for children, such as some of the marketing of the games. So what the language primarily does is just broaden the population that is to be protected from some of the downsides or unintended negative consequences of lottery products and practices. One of the other changes has to do with the requirement that the lottery employ, I believe it was a mental health practitioner or somebody with mental health background. And what I recommended there was what's most critical is that there is appropriate resources provided toward the activities to coordinate these programs, responsible gambling programs. And it does go in with the new language change addressing some of the issues that Larry brought up. That person would be responsible for reporting to the commission and also legislative bodies regarding the progress and the outcomes of any measures to reduce gambling-related harm.
Great. Thank you. Any questions of Dr. Murata? Okay, what we might want to do is call you both back. Larry, it's not fair to have you give us a response to this. I'm not going to move the bill today, and I'm not going to move the amendment either. So I'd give everybody a chance to look at this amendment and the bill more thoroughly, and we can call perhaps Dr. Murata back and Larry Nyswander back to give us more input. Anything in particular anybody would like to be getting more information about? All right. Thank you very much. We're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2163. And we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2355.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2355 has a revenue impact and a fiscal impact and subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It alters how funding for lottery proceeds are appropriated to the Problem Gambling Treatment Fund in a fiscal quarter.
Great. Harrison, oh good, you're already there. Terrific. So this is what's called a gut and stuff, which means this is a totally new bill. We'll have Harrison tell us about this.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Harrison Conley, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. This is one of those cases where I think if we look at the operative language in subsection 2 of the original bill, if someone had presented this language to me, I would have said, that's a model of ambiguity. What does the same fiscal quarter mean of the same fiscal year? And specifically, I think previous just plain does not work for the intentions that I understood. What I understand us to be doing with this draft is establishing a floor for a floor for revenues that are net proceeds that are available for the public purposes in the Constitution. So what we're attempting to do is actually establish the 2011 biennium as the low watermark that lottery that proceeds will always be available in at least that amount.
Harrison, I'm just going to stop there a second. I think it's the floor for the gambling treatment fund, right?
As I was saying, you're right. Yeah. What we have done is we have done not less than 1% of the monies transferred, not less than 1% of the net proceeds or the profits of lottery have been available for problem gambling. And so what we're doing is establishing the amount that was available in the biennium beginning 2011 as that floor. With the original language previous would have essentially given us a moving floor. We would have been looking at the biennium immediately before the biennium in which we were counting. So it required a little more complicated language to get to that result. Essentially, I think when we start in the fifth quarter in January 1, 2014, that is the fifth quarter of the eight quarters in a biennium. And I think that language does a better job of reflecting that each quarter when monies are allocated, we will look back to the appropriate quarter in 2011. If that is the low amount, if the amount that was raised in the current quarter is less than the amount that was raised in the similar quarter in 2011, the amount in 2011 will be available for the Problem Gambling Treatment Fund.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Harrison? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on this, what is in essence a new bill? Larry, come on up.
Hi,
You had a chance to look at it?
I did. Thank
Great.
You. Yes. Just briefly, Chair and committee members, again, for the record, Larry Nicewinder, Director of the Oregon Lottery. Current law does dedicate the 1%, and so it does fluctuate with revenues, although with the exception of since the recession happened in 2008 and 2009, those revenues have shown steady growth. So, you know, it does place kind of a parameter around it, so it does have some upside risks and some downside risks associated with tying it to any one biennium. In another committee, I was testifying about what's lottery revenues projected to do, and in the latest forecast that was given on February 15th, they do show that with the economic recovery, lottery funds different will grow back to a place based on the availability of discretionary income, and we are about 23% below previously achieved levels. So that's just a consideration for you as you set a 11-13 biennium limit on where the funding for this. The downside risk is that if as we grow that 1%, and we're reading it wrong, 1% would not necessarily go up. It's an absolutely setting a floor for the legislature to attend.
It's a floor.
It could go up.
It's a floor.
It could go up. Right.
Okay, so it could go up.
Correct,
but even if it was cut, it wouldn't go down below that.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That's helpful for me. And then the only other thing I just wanted to just, and it has a crossover effect, is just with this bill, because of the language in 2355, it touches on a section of the statutes that's really relevant to the previous bill. ORS 461-549 is a section of law that was established when that 1% dedication was put there. I just think it's important under the section 1 of that bill in lines 9 and 10 what the legislative intent was by passing this 1% dedication in the first place. And that is, it's in line 9, it says that it's to pay the costs of preventing and treating emotional and behavior problems related to gambling. So that was what the legislature chose to do because that was following on a court case that said that lottery couldn't directly fund services to prevent and treat. And so it just has, like I said, a carryover effect to the previous bill, and I just think since we're touching that statute, it was appropriate time to just talk a little bit about why it was originally put in there that way.
Thank you. Stay right there.
Chair Tomei, yes, I think Larry's pointing to the Ecumenical Ministries case, which, again, yes, I think as Larry sort of indicated, the Constitution says that the Oregon State Lottery Commission shall establish and operate the lottery. And the Ecumenical Ministries case flowed from a previous statute which had us require them to pay for the problem of treatment gambling as a cost of operating the lottery. The court said pretty clearly that the costs of problem gambling are not costs of administering the lottery. So I think that does, to some extent, reflect on some of the issues in the other bill. It may be that their mission is not to prevent the harms, it is to raise the money.
And how does that reflect on this bill, on 2355?
Well, I think Larry was just using this to illustrate why we have this section. This section was a response to the court saying, no, that's not a cost of the lottery. So we said after the fact, let's use 1% of the profits of the lottery since we cannot make it a cost of the lottery.
Yeah. And I guess the only other corresponding thing, Rez, is that it actually, in some respects, could be helping to identify if there is an alternative funding source needed for some things in the previous bill. This may be that alternative source, if not the general fund, if in fact it doesn't fall under lottery operations, as Harrison has said.
I think that's the first time I heard of that idea. Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Gail?
I was wondering how much of the lottery is going to pay for bonding right now of your general income for the lottery, and then do you see that increasing with time?
Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsitt, currently the legislatively adopted budget that's in place for this biennium has approved in total from previous biennium through this one, about $1.1 billion in lottery-bonded projects that are out there right now. There's another $150 million in the governor's balanced budget. So in another committee, there was testimony from the treasurer's office about how does lottery bond capacity likely to change over the near term, and it's relatively stable right now, but as their forecast for revenues go up, that capacity would also go up. But right now it's about $1.2 billion. It's nearing that 4x coverage requirement that they have under the Treasury bonded in requirements for debt service, because the debt service right now that the state is paying on a biennial basis is approximately $250 million on a fund stream that's $1.1 billion.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions?
I seem to remember in something that I read, I think it was from the work group that was making recommendations to the commission, was that the social costs are over $1 billion. Do I remember that correctly? Weren't you at the Transportation Committee meeting last week?
I don't remember. There may have been comments that I don't recall.
I'll try to find that and get that to the committee, because I think, you know, we're looking at $1 billion that the state is getting from the lottery, but if it's costing us with people losing their homes, people losing their jobs, people going into treatment, and as we know, people are embezzling a great deal of money. So maybe ending up, according to these figures, it ends up costing us more. Representative Gelsis, do you have a question? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And with that, I assume there's nobody else here who's... Yes, go on. And have you had a chance to look at the amendment?
I haven't had a chance to study.
Okay.
For the record, my name's Tom Moore, Wilsonville. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. I just wanted to bring up a couple things that may or may not be pertinent to that bill. One of the things, there were three revised statutes that put into effect the 1%, the fund, and then the problem gambling treatment services. What has happened in the past is the money has gone into the fund on a quarterly basis, but then that fund has been swept by the legislature. So that has created problems with the budget. So if there was something that could be put into that bill to protect that. The other thing is that there has been an occasion a few years ago where the Oregon, I can't remember their old name now, Human Services, now the Oregon Health Authority, did not get budget authority. And so there was money taken out of that too. So there's like this whole process that I think needs to be taken into account. You know, protecting the funds, we're all for, but if we could protect those funds in the fund and we make sure that the authority is given in a timely manner.
And I think the problem that we've talked in the past about is that then for that last quarter, if there is not the money that had been predicted going to treatment, that people often leave the program. And so we lose the people who are providing treatment, and it's hard to build that back up again. Is that correct?
Absolutely. When we look at the treatment data, we can look at the ups and downs, and the dramatic decreases in enrollments have come when there's been budget shortfalls. And it's taken a long time to recover that. And as has been said in previous testimony, the infrastructure is lost.
Right.
And it just takes time to build those back up and get counselors back in there. And then people to come back to a program. If they called and they couldn't get into the program, they're more less likely to call again, too.
Right. Absolutely. Harrison, could you come back again? Is there some way to protect this fund from sweeps?
Chair, if I may, Harrison Conlon. I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch what fund is being swept.
The treatment, the 1% for treatment.
Chair Tomei, probably not. That is a matter within the legislature's discretion. Certainly in the special session, we learned a little bit more about statutory contracts, and it might be possible to find someone on the other side who would give consideration for dedicating that money, but I don't think so.
Representative Wilson.
You know, Madam Chair, I look a perfect example of what Harrison's talking about, I think, is Senate Bill 1145, which was passed by this body back in 95. It created the community service in relationship with the sheriffs, too. And there was kind of an agreement to go into that process to fund the community corrections and the sheriffs properly from us in order then to release people from the Department of Corrections the last 12 months of their time that they were serving. So you just kind of did the transition. We have not even come close to meeting that obligation that we had made an agreement with back then. But again, it's a perfect example of, I don't know how you hold another legislative session body, you know, accountable for our actions today with this.
That's discouraging. Thank you.
Yes,
so I'm guessing that. Only if you put it in the Constitution.
That's the only way you do it.
Other pieces of the lottery. Yeah, but I mean, I think that's
the only fair way.
Yeah. Not that I'm suggesting it.
Oh.
Thank you. Ship 2000 had swept.
Any other questions?
Culture trust.
Discussion. Thank you both very much for coming. I appreciate it. With this, Mr. Vice Chair, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2355, the work session on House Bill 2355. So we're going to work on this some more. I think our committee that worked on it, that included Representative Kenny Geyer, that we're pretty committed to both these bills. And I think they need some work and clarification. So we'll work on these and come back and hopefully be able to have a work session where we can pass these. So thank you very much. Committee, I'm going to have to leave, and I've asked President Wilson if he would chair the next part of the meeting. Great. Thank you all.
Thank you, ma'am. See you later.
See you later.
Good talking to you today, Madam Chair.
See you all. Thank you all.
You just want to give her the wave? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Just stay tuned. Here, just a moment. We're getting... Yes, thanks for the who to call it?
For the informational hearing. We do have a couple of people that are on the agenda. Here's Jill Davis from DHS.
Hey, Jill? Okay, no. So you're... No, you're not going to do it?
But I will give you the name.
Okay, is Jerry coming up?
Okay. There they are right there.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to open up an informational hearing right now, and it involves seniors and elders abuse. And we have invited, okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So Mike McCormick and Marie Corvantes. Okay.
Yes. Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and with me is Marie Cervantes, who is the director of the DHS Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, and I'm the deputy director for DHS Aging and People with Disabilities, and we appreciate the opportunity to present before you today. So I'm going to give you a brief overview of the long-term care system in Oregon and talk about the actions that we have underway, and then I'm going to transition to Marie, who's going to talk about some of the actions going on around elder abuse. Oregon received the nation's first home and community-based services waiver in the entire nation in 1981. It allows, under Medicaid law, recipients have the right to receive long-term care services in a nursing facility. The waiver allows individuals to waive that right and receive services in home and community-based settings. So Oregon was revolutionary in being the first state to do this, and today we're still nationally recognized. Many considering Oregon to be the national leader. Recently, an AARP report ranked Oregon number 3 amongst all 50 states. And the benefit of this development is that it benefits both the individuals accessing services under Medicaid as well as those accessing services under private pay. Like, for example, assisted living facilities. On average throughout the state, around 40% of the individuals residing in assisted living facilities receive services through Medicaid, the remainder through private pay or other payer sources. So this development benefited all Oregonians. We also have a rich network of adult foster homes and a very capable workforce of home care workers, in-home agencies who can serve people in their own homes. So Oregon is very proud of its long-term care system. They refer to it as a social model of long-term care. It's not based upon, you know, diagnosis like having a stroke or having need for diabetic care. It's more around needing assistance with activities of daily living, bathing, toileting, transferring, cognition, etc. So I love this slide, and for those of you that were involved in the health system transformation last session, they always showed this graph illustrating that only 10% So an individual's overall health, only 10% of that is driven by the provision of medical services. The other areas, lifestyle and behavior, 40%, social, 15%, environmental, 5%, and genetics, 30%. Oregon's long-term care system contributes in all of these areas with the exception of genetics. Long-term care provides some medical care in conjunction with the provision of long-term care. We do things like lifestyle and behavior. For example, we support individuals with disabilities that are attending college who need a personal care assistant to help them while they're there and help them integrate in the community, you know, improving their overall health and well-being. Social model, transporting to adult day services for socialization, getting to the grocery store, etc. Environmental, of course, a clean living environment. Our community-based care facilities themselves contribute towards this. So we're very proud of Oregon's system of long-term care. One of the most frequently asked questions I get is, how much does Oregon save through its high utilization of home and community-based services? And this is a very difficult question to answer, but we figured out a better way to answer it. We decided to compare ourselves against the state of Connecticut, who has very almost identical population size and similar demographics as to Oregon. So today, we're serving about 84% of our long-term care population in home and community-based settings. The average cost of $1,603 per month. Nursing facility, we're only serving 16% of individuals at a cost of $5,512 per month. So if Oregon looked like Connecticut, you can see the difference in the overall cost. And so we estimate that Oregon's model, as compared to the Connecticut model, saves over $1 billion a biennium.
Wow.
So while we're very proud of Oregon's system, there's nothing broke with Oregon's system, there are opportunities for improvement. The example I give most often is we have fewer people as a percentage of the long-term care caseload served in their own homes today than we did a few years ago. That trend is going in the opposite direction that we want. Nursing facility utilization continues to go down. Community-based care, we have a wonderful provider base, but that percentage of the caseload continues to go up dramatically, or not dramatically, but as the nursing facility caseload is decreasing, it's getting picked up by the community-based care side. There are a lot of barriers to in-home services that prevent someone from being served in their own home. Like, we don't authorize technology, we need to develop our own workforce, We have issues that we have. We require participants to live in absolute poverty. So what is 3.0? What the system I described to you, the comparison to Connecticut, is really 2.0. 3.0 is around taking our system to their next level. And it's all around designing and administering a system of long-term services and supports that delivers the right services at the right time at the right place. So, for example, a preventative service package could potentially keep someone independent for a longer period of time, ultimately saving money to both the healthcare system and the long-term care system. Those are the goals of 3.0. It's not around diluting our system at all or rationing services. It's really about making smart investments that will keep people independent and healthier for a longer period of time. So we rolled out this initiative in 45 presentations across the state, around 550 attendees. 80% said that we were on the right track with our agenda. 76% support taking now. High support, 80% for a preventative services package. 74% said that we should remove barriers to prevent people from residing in their own homes. And then the most controversial part, when we went out on these tours, we asked people, would you want to restrict an individual's ability to access long-term care services in a nursing facility to only those that are most in need? With the assumption that most people don't really want to live in a nursing facility. They want to be there for a short period of time, rehab, and transition to a less restrictive setting. This was very controversial. Only 55% supported that. There was a high percentage that also said, I'm not sure, and 12% downright opposed any change to our system at all. Behind this, there's a lot of work going on in APD trying to improve our long-term care system. This work is supported by Senate Bill 21, where we're asking the legislature for permission to engage in a planning process and report back to the legislature in 2014. So before I hand it off to Marie, let me pause and see if there are any questions on my portion of the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about the people that are putting themselves in long-term health care? You're going to talk about, in your presentation, talk about that.
Vice Chair Olson, Representative Wisnant, I don't understand your question. Can you rephrase it, please?
Well, we're talking about people living in, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
We're talking about people living in their home or living in a facility. But the facility you're talking about is people that are the state's paying for, the feds are paying for. But what if you have private insurance to do that? What's for the disabilities, Alzheimer's and things?
Vice Chair Olson, Representative Wisnant, the long-term care system is quite complex. So if for individuals accessing services through Medicaid, they basically have their choice of any option available, including in-home, including community-based care, private pay. There's a lot of factors that go into that depending upon an individual's ability to pay. And then long-term care insurance, different policies have different things that they'll cover. There's no consistency to what is a benefit available under long-term care insurance.
Mr. Chairman, clarify, apologize. Late afternoon, it's a long day, it's Monday. My question is, is that affecting the people you're serving? The people have their own insurance to select how they're doing. You're giving us a briefing on people that are the state's paying for.
Yeah.
And so, how is the people, or more people, buying long-term health insurance not, and how is that affecting your data?
I apologize. Vice Chair Olson, Representative Wisnant, we haven't performed any studies to assess the impact of Oregonians not purchasing long-term care insurance and the effect that has on the Medicaid system. What I can tell you is that today we are serving significantly fewer Oregonians than we were in the year 2003. Our caseload is basically flat there's, you know, maybe a percent up, a percent down, but we are not experiencing overwhelming demand for our services yet. But part of what 3.0 is about preparing our system for when the boomer population need long-term care services. That day isn't here yet. It's not an immediate crisis. I'm not suggesting it is.
Okay. Any other questions? Maria.
Thank you. Chair Olson, vice chairs, members of the committee, have already been introduced, so I'm going to go ahead and thank you for the opportunity to share some information with you today. In the next seven slides, I'm going to cover a little bit about who we serve, who we are, our future direction, the number of investigations and abuse by type, and then an example of our performance metrics. So we'll go ahead and begin with the creation of the new office. It began in March of 2012. That's when it was established, although there was a lot of work behind the scenes that began in the spring of 2011. You will see in the bullet points below the description of our office, the people that we serve. What I want to bring to your attention about those individuals is where they live. They might live in their own home in the community, at the state hospital, in an adult foster home, a residential treatment facility. Just to name a few of the places. Who are we? Essentially, our office, which is also referred to as OAPI, Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation, provides standards, policy, and data research analysis, technical assistance, training, outreach to the community, administrative and legal functions such as due process hearings. We are the central service or the framework that sustains the mission-critical functions of the program. We have investigators that are located in 36 counties around the state that carry out a lot of those missions, and they do that in collaboration and partnership with our office. Our focus on research and abuse prevention is because we're learning more about early trauma in life as children and the impact that it has on adult victims of abuse. On this slide, you'll see on the left hand, that's where we've been within our system, and the right hand side of the slide is where we're going. So left hand, multiple abuse investigation units with different missions, visions, values, multiple rules, training programs, report writing systems, etc. On the right side is where we're moving. We've been following the DHS model for leading into the future, as shown in this slide. So we're thinking more proactive about abuse rather than being reactive. Our design efforts were meant to maximize efficiencies, learn best practice from the investigators that work with the different populations that we serve, standardize processes, and ensure service equity to all the people that we serve. So this is just a snapshot. This is not all of the goals of our office, but this gives you an idea of where we're moving to in the future. Next, I'd like to focus on our investigations. We've received more than 28,000 reports of abuse, and approximately half of those were investigated. What this data does not reflect is a serious issue of underreporting. There is as many as 1 in 5 cases to as high as 1 in 57 that are underreported for different types of abuse. And this becomes critical when you consider research that suggests, for example, individuals with developmental disabilities are 4 to 10 times more likely to be victimized. So this is what we know about abuse. It's what we don't know about abuse that can be misleading about these numbers. And that's where the community outreach and the research. Some of the reasons why we
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Mm-hmm. Representative Gelser has a question for you there.
Thank you very much. And this kind of goes to that point that you were making. Is there a way to get a sense of the incidence of that number? So, for instance, we see 11,619 complaints of abuse for adults over 65 and adults with physical disabilities, which is a pretty large population compared to the number of children, and those are children with developmental disabilities in residential treatment where there's a couple hundred. Is there a way to see that number as a percentage of the population?
Yeah, if you were to look like, you mean the Oregon demographics, Representative Gelser?
Yes, exactly. So I might look at those numbers and without that data think, wow, I'm much more likely to be abused if I'm over the age of 65 than I am if I'm a child with a developmental disability in residential care, when in fact the flip is true. If that looks like that's probably about, what, if you have about 450 kids in residential treatment, that's about 1 in 4.
Yes. Tara Olson, Representative Gelser, that's exactly the point that I was making with the underreporting and the victimization rates. This is what we see. This is what we report. I don't have that data available, but I can sure get that for you and bring that back and report back. But that is exactly the point that I was making. This is abuse we do know. When you look at those victimization rates, those numbers could look very different.
And I guess follow-up? I think the point was slightly different. So even among the information that we do know, 161 of 450 or 500 kids is a higher rate of occurrence of even what is reported than 11,619 of hundreds of thousands of people that are in that population. So the size of the pond from which we're pulling these reports, does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yes. Chair Olson, Representative Gelser, I believe you're talking about the abuse rate. And you're right. The abuse rate for people with developmental disabilities is actually 42%, and for adults with physical disabilities and seniors is 40%. So it is higher. If that's what you're asking about, is clarification of about the abuse rate.
We can follow up. Okay. We can follow up later. That's not my.
Can I add something?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Yeah, so I think there's two numbers that you might be getting at. One is for the 161 reports on investigations, what percentage of the population is that of children who are in residential treatment, as opposed to the 11,000, what percentage of people over 65 and adults with physical disabilities is that? So that's, you know, what percentage of that given population are being reported and investigated. The second thing that would be interesting is, of those investigations, how much actually result in substantiated abuse, I guess you call it.
Okay.
Those are two different numbers, so I think that would be very interesting.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gelser. Representative Kenny Geyer, I'll bring that information back for you. Some of the reasons why people may not report, they might be afraid to tell what happened. There could be a fear of having to move, a loss of independence, retaliation. They may not understand or be able to communicate what happened to them. So that's just some of the reasons around underreporting. For the next slide, these are some of the most common abuse types for 2011. We also investigate allegations of sexual abuse, verbal, emotional abuse, involuntary seclusion, and wrongful restraint. We are careful not to minimize other types of abuse, as the consequences of any type of abuse is they're devastating. So another example, if you look at research that shows 50% of people in psychiatric settings have a history of sexual or physical abuse, that can tell you what that means about the abuse trends, and that 80% of women with developmental disabilities have been sexually abused, and 32 to 54% of men. So even though the percentages show what they are, we don't minimize any of the different types, even though the percentages may be lower. Go ahead and move on to measuring performance. You look at the five key areas. The first three are what we call our routine work. Those are called also process measures. Those are things that we must do well. Response time means we get out on time, we receive a call of abuse, we're out on site or we're making a call to an individual of a report of abuse. Now, report completion is exactly how it sounds. It is around the timeline for a report being completed. Inconclusive findings is a quality assurance measure. And the final two bullet points are around outcomes. We keep an eye on the rate of abuse and the rate of re-abuse. So we measure these the effectiveness of these performance areas to tell us how we're doing, and it's to achieve outcomes or better outcomes for the victims that we serve. We also perform different quality assurance checks, so we're doing audits of our screening, making sure we're screening cases in and out appropriately, and looking at other areas of our program.
Could we hold off a little bit here right now, Marie and Mike, and change out here? We've got, yes, Representative Hoyle. And also Representative Gilliam here to say, and then President Gallegos, we'll get to your question here. If we can pull you back up here in a little bit, but we need to shift gears here a little bit for timing. Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Do you want to talk up here in front of us?
But I think you'd be better, sir, yep, to finish this.
Really? Okay. Okay, Representative Gallegos, you had a question.
While you're sitting down.
Okay, we're back in.
The question I have, it relates to the previous discussion as well, but maybe it's here in the last slide, I don't know, but it has to do with outcome and performance as well. I'd be interested in the ethnic breakdown and also the income breakdown, and I just, you know, have you implemented some diverse interventions, and are you looking at, you just said you had some quality kind of assurance. To what extent do those take into account sort of cultural differences, and I said even income differences? Because I would anticipate you might see different kinds of abuse with different kinds of cultural issues and so on.
Yes, Chair Olson, Representative Gallegos. Certainly there are cultural differences. Our office is just beginning to understand those with the research that we're doing. This is our first year of the new office, and we certainly have just hired a person to do grant writing and research analysis to help us understand that better. So we don't have the data available. It is something that we look to gather in the future. Probably the closest information we would have to that is a small study that we did on financial abuse that told us the type of instruments, the money that was used, whether food stamps were lost, et cetera. That would be the closest to the income type information that I believe you're seeking.
Well, thank you. I just would suggest that would be a really critical thing. Again, if we're looking at effective outcomes, I mean, it would be critical, I would think. So thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Okay, for our last slide, measuring performance. This is just one sample of our performance. This is for the county developmental disability cases and state-operated community programs that were completed by OAPI. As you can see, in 2010, the average case length was 141 days. In 2011, 98 days. 2012, 60 days, which means we went from 100 days overdue to 15 days within 2 years. Some of the reasons why you might see a case go longer than what is typical, and one of the reasons why we have a policy in place around extensions, or there might be witnesses that are unavailable. There might be a criminal investigation going on, and we might be asked to hold off on our investigation or interviewing an accused person, or we might have a very complex case that we need to have a forensic consultant guide us on. So just to wrap it up and close, that's a quick snapshot for you. I would encourage you to think about abuse globally and raise the importance of this issue for all the people we serve. Abuse has consequences to all victims, families, and to society overall. And all the people that we serve are deserving of improved health, safety, and well-being. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, now we'll try once again. Representative Hoyle, Representative Gilliam, and Bethany, if you'd like to come on up.
Anything good is worth waiting for.
Who's going to go first?
Thank you very much for allowing us to testify today.
You guys were part of a work group last year, the last couple of years, yeah. So. Are you going to go first then, Representative Gilliam, since you're part of our committee here?
Thank you, Representative Tomei, Chair. I can't see her. Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, fellow members of the committee, my name is Vic Gilliam, and I'm from Silverton, and I represent District 18, and I'm going to quickly kick this off to give you all just a quick reminder of where we've been and where we are. The good chair that I was teasing in her absence, because I would never do that when she's here, started this And she started it because there was an expose in the Oregonian about elder abuse in our state. And I've stated this before, and I'll state it again. Instead of Representative Tomei taking the offensive and the department taking the defensive, they decided to work together. And the new director at that time pulled together the first task force that Representative Hoyle and I sat in on as legislators. We were invited. Out of that task force came the first bill to form a task force. This is the way the legislature works. But in this case, it actually did work because we took, there were a number of stakeholders, and probably every single stakeholder in dealing with elder abuse in Oregon was on that task force. Many of them came over on the other work group that we formed. We took their work, and that's when we were able to put together and pass the bill that we passed last session on elder abuse prevention. Some things were in the bill that we worked hard for, and some of them didn't make it. But among other things were tools for law enforcement regarding elder abuse, particularly in the financial area. I'm going to let Representative Hoyle talk a little bit about that. But I just wanted to remind you of the cooperation that that work represents, all the cooperation, again, with this newly formed committee as we move forward. We took a break from the task force at the end of the session because the bill called for the patient review committee to meet in the summer. The most important part of what you're going to hear today is from Bethany on what happened in that committee and the focus on definition and on, I'll never forget the other point.
Process.
And you'll see how important that is for us to move forward in our work for another bill that builds on the work we did last session. So with that, I turn it over to my co-chair of the task force, Representative Hoyle.
Hi, Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to hear us today. In the time that I've been in the legislature, I've done a lot of things, worked on a lot of things, voted on a lot of bills, but none I feel were as important as the work that we did in this work group. I'm also very grateful for those of you who voted on the bill that was brought forward that actually made some substantial changes that that help people in need and save lives. So the Elder Abuse Work Group created in 2011 with House Bill 2325, our task was to define elder abuse and rethink the process for prevention, investigation, and appropriate reporting of elder abuse. We only had the February session, so we had to figure out what we could do that didn't cost money, because we didn't have money, that we could get through in a short session. And our participants included people from long-term care facilities, district attorneys, police investigators, adult protective services, long-term care ombudsman, AARP, trial attorneys. We had input from the ACLU, from criminal defense attorneys, a lot of input. And we came out with, the House Bill 4084, and the goal was to bring the elder abuse statutes in line with our child abuse statutes. So we specifically stopped the two-year record expungement for conviction of elder abuse and some other crimes that, like animal abuse, where if someone commits this crime, we find that they really shouldn't be in the place of taking care of vulnerable people. Permitted law enforcement access to health and financial records only during an investigation. And increased the time to prosecute crimes against Oregon seniors, because it takes a long time to find out when someone is being financially abused. It's very difficult to get that information. We added animal abuse, forgery, and child neglect to the list of crimes that bars convicted individuals from working with vulnerable Oregonians, and we took some of the crimes off the list. Specifically, we had some people who maybe did something not very smart in their early 20s, and but as they're older, they're responsible, they could show that they could be responsible enough. Again, we took some of those crimes off the list. So we also created the Resident Safety Review Council, and this is where you're going to hear a report shortly. And that was charged with examining the relationship between adverse events and instances of alleged abuse. And the council recently submitted their recommendations to our work group, and that's what's going to be presented to you today. So again, I want to thank you for your time, and Bethany Walmsley is the executive director of the Oregon Patient Safety
Commission.
There you go. I was like, council committee. I cannot read my writing. And she's going to give you the report.
Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Bethany Walmsley. I'm the executive director, as Representative Hoyle was saying, of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and I had the honor of chairing the Resident Safety Review Council in this work. Yay, it's back awake again. That's wonderful. Okay, so I'm aware that it's been a long day, and I'm going to try to get through this as quickly as possible. Please know that these slides were developed for the full report to the Elder Abuse Work Group, and so I feel the need under the time commitment here to kind of cherry-pick these as much as I can and get to the really important stuff. You can see here that there was a very diverse membership to this group. It's very multidisciplinary. We had ombudsman, law enforcement, and, of course, I was operating as chair. I think we had, the one thing I want you to understand about the members of this group is that we all brought different perspectives to the table, and I think that the group itself really had a lot of value because of those different perspectives that we brought to these discussions. Okay, this is definitely not working. Excuse me for a moment. Let's see if we try it this way. Okay. So they've already reviewed the council's charge with you, so I think I'll skip through this and then go right to these are the three main activities that we basically conducted as a council in a very short period of time. We performed a case review for closed investigations. We did panel interviews with a number of people, and then also we really evaluated the state abuse definitions across the country. You can see here how compressed our timeline was. As you said, as they were saying, over the summer, we spent our time really doing a lot of good work, and so you can see that reflected here in this timeline. The case review itself, I want to get to the meat of the matter here and tell you what we found from the actual study. For those of you that are not familiar, what we were really looking for is the relationship between abuse investigation or occurrences of actual abuse and the overlap that could occur with adverse events. So adverse events are those things that happen that are most of the time preventable, that are really system-related versus something where there was actual intent for harm from an individual or something like that. So we're looking for that relationship for a very specific reason, because when human beings are working in those very complicated systems, it's important to identify where those opportunities are. And there are opportunities to prevent reoccurrence in the future, and I think that's why we're all here talking about this. So at the end of the day, you'll see that this sample was basically taken from the neglect and physical abuse categories, because that is the only areas where we felt that there was true overlap with the potential for an adverse event occurring. The other thing, by definition, that could not occur, and therefore we didn't focus on that. I'll skip the actual methods that we used, but I will tell you that they were not just made up. They were very evidence-based, and if you want to know about those details, I think you have a copy of the full report in front of you. Basically, making the decision throughout this case review, you can see that it fell into three categories here. It either had the potential to be an adverse event, it was not one, or it was excluded for the algorithm for several reasons, such there was no evidence that there in the record that there was an event that occurred, or there was a personal choice by on behalf of the resident, or other things like that that you see listed here that would cause it to fall out. And ultimately, what we found, which is pretty interesting, I think, is that conservatively, I can honestly tell you that 35% of what we saw in these two categories were truly adverse events. They were absolutely things that if the caregiver had been in the right place at the right time, that could have happened to them as well. It was clear that they were system-related, preventable adverse events that are a part of our very complex health delivery system. So that we'll put a placeholder on that.
Mr. Chair, go from there. This might be helpful, Bethany. It always helped me to just have an example of an adverse event.
Sure. Mm-hmm. The nurse is delivering meds to a patient. Those meds are on a tray. The colors of the meds are very similar. They get mixed up. The patient ultimately ends up with the wrong medication.
So you're talking about there wasn't, like, criminal intent?
Exactly.
Like that. Okay.
Exactly.
You're talking negligence. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So moving on to just the basics of what we learned through this review is that there's a real opportunity here to understand what occurred and strengthen the system underneath it so you can prevent recurrence, number one. And then also that this system could be designed in a way so that that's infused into it, so that the abuse investigation process itself really drives that accountability for prevention into it. In addition, this is a very paper-heavy process, let's put it that way. We spent a lot of time delving through boxes of paper. So because of that, there's obviously a higher opportunity for human error, and therefore there were inconsistencies in documentation and other things that are really an opportunity. And one of the recommendations that you'll see later really speaks to this a little further. We also conducted panel interviews, and these interviews were conducted with the APS investigators, the corrective action personnel, and also some long-term care providers. It was important to us that we find a way to get that sort of on-the-ground perspective around what they felt was workable within the system, what was not working well, where areas where they saw there could be improvement. And there were several common themes that were identified. So I'll share those with you now. As Marie was saying earlier, there are several barriers to self-reporting. Technology improvements are desperately needed. The civil penalty structure could benefit from some redesign. I'm aware that DHS is already starting to work on some of that, but that's something that's definitely an opportunity. There were also multiple inconsistencies between the interpretation, application, and the definition itself. So when you start talking process and definition, this is where that relationship becomes very tied to the other. It gets harder to pull that apart. There are situations where the broad definition of abuse is problematic, and so we'll be talking about in the definition, in the recommendations of the definition part a little bit more. And then we did a full definition review because we felt like to meet our charge, we needed to have a better understanding of what was out there across the nation around at least the statutory level of abuse definitions. And what we really focused on were four areas: who was protected, what was investigated, what's determined from that, and then how is that information presented to the public and to the providers. So here's basically what we learned from that review. Is no surprise, there's no silver bullet out there. There's no state that's doing this so well that we could easily transfer that into Oregon. But the umbrella term of abuse is used to represent all stages of the process. And right now, that means ensuring that protection piece, triggering the investigation, making that determination, and also the public reporting piece. So it leads to confusion. It can be a problem for transparency and reporting, and I think that's really the most important thing that I want to make sure that I verbally mention. So let's go to some of the key findings that were from this. Paper is a barrier, I already mentioned that, to a more efficient system. Subjective language in the statutory abuse definitions is certainly problematic. The process does seem to lack, at this point in time, an improvement prevention focus, although I know that that has been mentioned and is now starting to be more of a focus. But in general, there's a negative stigma that's very attached to the overall term of abuse, and it really is working against this transparency piece in a really large way. And so the variation in these definitions across the populations and the care settings is also impeding reporting. So the definition you see is not necessarily the same for behavioral, et cetera. So that's also a confusing factor. Just a quick word before I skip through the 10 recommendations. We worked very hard to preserve these fresh perspectives that I mentioned to you before. I think those are important, and we really tried hard to take a very fresh look at this. We really tried to keep our focus on the protection for Oregonians, and as Representative Gilliam mentioned before, process and definition became our really two main categories of recommendations. And I will just repeat again that pulling them apart or saying, well, we'll just do this one piece, it becomes really difficult to do that. This is a very complicated system. So process and definition have a relationship to each other. And so just cherry picking these and say, well, let's just do this one, doesn't really work. It's the domino effect. So the first one, let's see if I can go back. Sorry. Sorry about that. I'll get to recommendation number one. Did Technology is great when it works out, huh?
Less paper.
All right. Process recommendation number one, improving the investigation and reporting technology. Okay, so this is the number one thing. I mentioned the paper-heavy process. It's definitely a burden. We recognize that there would be an initial fiscal impact to this, but I can tell you that it's very apparent that it would also help to eliminate a lot of rework and a lot of inefficiency in the system. So I think that goes without saying that having the updated system would really improve the process in general. And so things like timeliness and all of that would get a lot easier. And that transparency piece shouldn't be understated. That's a really important piece as well. So computerizing that process itself, creating an actual investigation database that's more fully functional, and also analytic tools and other processes that could be put into place with better technology so that you had the data you needed for planning and staffing and not having to piece that together all the time with a more challenged system. Developing an online tool to determine if an event is reportable as abuse could also be of benefit. I won't go into a lot of detail here. It's certainly outlined within the report. But basically, that's a really big challenge right now. There's a lot of misperception, and even though we think that we've communicated clearly about it, there's opportunities to improve that. The technology could help with all of that. Developing an abuse investigation algorithm is our second recommendation as a part of the process. For those of you, I'm sure all of you are familiar with what this means. What we're basically saying is deploying a process within the technology that would allow you, through a series of yes-no questions, drop these investigations into a category so it was clear. It helps lift some of that burden and choice, subjectivity, if you will, off the decision maker who is reporting it, and it also just clears up the communication across the board. There's a lot of work that could be done to try to make the process more straightforward if this could be accommodated. So it helps to clearly categorize, it creates that objectivity, and it includes that determination piece for adverse events. So I think that's a really important piece that we don't want to miss, and this could help with that categorization. Recommendation number three. A more comprehensive training and education program. I am aware that DHS right now is working to improve this. However, it was across the board when we did our panel interviews that APS workers, providers, all the mandatory reporters, there's opportunities here to improve training and education, the consistency of that training, enhance that training, and also the routine circling back, if you will, for continuous improvement. So there's a lot of things that could be done here to improve that. So standardizing the training and developing the ongoing program, these are the training components that were identified as very helpful. There's different pieces you can see here for each one of the cohorts that I named. Recommendation number four is evaluate and consider restructuring the civil penalty system. So this is a way of looking at this so that we know that you want the punishment to fit the crime. That's a terrible phrase to use here, but that's important to say because there are times when you're wondering if this fine is really going to result in the change or impact you would like to see. So by redesigning the system and also then considering how to track that over time so that if you had better technology to support it, you could make enhancements along the way, that's something to think about here.
Can I ask a question there?
Mr. Chair? Representative Kinnegar.
Hi, right now, civil penalties, are any of them used for restitution to the victims?
Could one of my colleagues from DHS perhaps answer that question? They're still here. Yeah, I don't know. I apologize for not knowing the answer to that. I didn't think so, but I...
So that might be another thing to consider.
Yeah.
So, Mike, do you know if there's a connection between restitution and civil penalty?
I do not.
Okay.
Okay.
At this point, no.
There's okay.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
So in general, it also gets back to the infusion of that prevention piece that we're really looking for as a theme. So the quality improvement focus piece is also, just idea is develop a system that will help prevent the reoccurrence and go a long way to promote that prevention and quality improvement piece. Process recommendation number 5 is exploring the idea of a long-term care worker registry. Currently, right now, there are gaps within the current system and the background checks. There is the possibility, if you look at the different criteria here, that someone could bounce from facility to facility in short order, and someone who is known to be a risk could get employed by another facility, and we want to try to close that gap. So that's where that recommendation comes from. Process recommendation number 6 is to enhance support for multidisciplinary teams. Right now, I think most of you are probably aware, the district attorney in each county is required to coordinate the multidisciplinary team. And although it's really important to have this in place, this is the group that they have to coordinate. There are some realities, though, that are associated with this so that this can all come together. And their ability to coordinate that right now is very challenging. So many counties don't have the support or the resources to implement the mandate, and the sharing of resources across counties, for example, could be a way to help improve that. Now we're going to move into the definition recommendations very quickly. Recommendation number 7, align the definitions across settings and populations. So as I mentioned before, regardless of the individual's age and care setting, the consistency to align these definitions would reduce confusion, you know, among the provider community, the investigators themselves, and other interested parties. Of course, we'd have to be careful that the nursing homes would have to adhere to those federal abuse definitions as well. One state that does already do this that we noticed in our review is Arkansas. We're not necessarily suggesting that we do it exactly the way that they do, but basically multiple populations are covered in a single statute, and the way they split this out is they say long-term care facility residents and state hospital patients, and then those who are not. And they go that way instead of having definitions for every single category. Recommendation number 8 under definition is distinguish between application versus determination. As I mentioned before, right now these are lumped together. A clarity for abuse determinations is certainly recommended. This is one of the areas where there's a lot of, it is problematic. So applying more clearly defined categories to the final determination could improve transparency and the understanding from the investigators and the providers and the public. So considering a distinct category for neglect, although that is a subcategory right now, it tends to act as a catch-all right now, and so we really need to work on being more clear about that one. Establishing a tiered system could also be supported through the algorithm that I mentioned before. So I want to make sure that you understand that what we're basically saying here is that technology algorithm could help with all of this. This is where the integration comes in. So we could also use current research and practice to inform how these determinations are defined, with our goal being prevention, of course. Recommendation number 9, increase clarity for jurisdiction and reports of potential abuse. So this is problematic for individual reporters and the screeners receiving the reports. There are that variability across the care settings, of course. Better guidelines are needed for the triage itself, and improving clarity within the triage process could support improved communication for everyone. This is just a suggestion for a triage structure that what could be included. And then finally, recommendation number 10, consider select definition changes. We're making some recommendations here about how to clarify certain areas within the statute we think that need more definition. And then in addition to that, there's things like separating emotional abuse from verbal abuse. You can see here that verbal abuse is a form of emotional abuse. However, not all emotional abuse is verbal. So there's an opportunity there as well. Then there's a way to talk about, are we comfortable with what we have in statute versus what we have in rule, and making sure we've taken a fresh look at that. So setting the priorities for next steps, believe it or not, this is the final slide. one thing I want to emphasize here is that in our short time together, I think we did a really nice job in casting a light on all of the different areas that need attention, focusing and prioritizing on what could maybe give us the most bang for our buck. We have a really clear understanding now of where some of the opportunities are for improvement. We have a long way to go, other than the recommendations that you'll see in the report, in working a little more closely together so that we can get a better idea of what some of those solutions could look like. So for these 4 areas, we believe these are the priority areas that need to have a deeper dive. It's developing the abuse definition algorithm, improving the investigation and reporting technology piece. The definitions themselves need to have a, we need to have a fresh look at that. And then the long-term care worker registry we think is worth spending some time on. So with that, I will close. And please, I'm very happy to entertain any questions.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the great presentation and all the work on this important issue. I guess one of the things that I'm confused about is whether the statute that you're looking at adapting is specifically within the long-term care and senior system, or if it would be more broadly applied to vulnerable adults. And the reason that I ask, some of the definitions and kind of the issues of, you know, medication, abuse, not abuse, is different in a different service setting than it is in a long-term care setting. So is this going to encompass our community-based developmental disability systems, or are you going to let the DD system kind of stay where it is with the work that was done there with that committee through a very long work group process several years ago?
Vice Chair Olson, Representative Gelser, I couldn't agree more. I think we have to work out some of the ways to preserve that work that was done. I do think that the way that Arkansas did it would help preserve what you're talking about, which is saying, you know, nursing home is these definitions, outside of that is this, and we could look at it that way. But I think there's work to be done there to make sure that we do it correctly. This is a really complex, definitions piece is extremely complex.
And just as a follow-up, some of the words that were there were very particularly important to the developmental disability community you're talking about changing, and could really put them at risk. It really is a very different population with different needs. So I'm wondering if these changes in definitions would apply to that population, would you consider inviting the DD community into these conversations, or is the intent really to kind of have long-term care and then leave these others in that area?
Yeah, so thank you, Vice Chair Olson, Representative Gelser. The intent was to work within, specifically for this portion, within the long-term care community, predominantly with seniors, but we do understand that there are long-term care facilities for the DD population, and anything that we do that in any way would affect that population, we would work to ensure, we would ensure, I can give you the commitment for myself, and I'll speak for my co-chair, that we would invite people from the DD community to ensure that nothing we do changes the really good work that happened previously, but we'll build upon that and you know, we acknowledge that there are different needs for different communities, but there certainly is some overlap.
And one further follow-up. Thank you. So if it seems like the focus is nursing home and long-term care facilities, so the focus would not be foster care, group home, supported living, brokerage, employment setting.
Vice Chair Olson, Representative Gelser. It would not in this, for this particular aspect of what we're doing, but for some other things, for instance, background check that work that we're doing, or some of the other pieces of work that this group might touch, it would actually impact group homes or adult foster care facilities, but for this particular set of work that we're doing, it is nursing homes, long-term care, and not those other facilities that you just mentioned.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Yeah, I can see, I mean, what Representative Gelser was saying, I can really see some of the crossovers, I mean, for wanting to be consistent with the definitions as well as then also the investigative side of it as well as the reporting side of it. That would, I mean, that just makes sense too, so. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I just, in closing, would just like to say we passed the last bill out on, there were three no votes out of 90. And so this was a bipartisan work group, worked very well with my co-chair. It was a bipartisan bill, and we very much would like to do something that we could get everyone to support because it is very, very important work.
Well, thank you very much for doing that. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I'm giving our chair a hard time. I'm just wondering where you're going with this in this session. Are there bills that are to be drafted or already drafted?
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Vice Chair Olson, Representative Kenny Geyer. We will pull together information from the work group, and we have placeholder bills that we'll use. But again, before we do anything, before we make those proposals, we will come back and check in with this committee.
And I would add to that, if I might have Vic Gilliam for the record. This report that you just saw is going to be a major driver in us moving forward. I think the work is extraordinary, and the group that came together was extraordinary. And you got the short version, and the long version is equally important. Mm. We spared you from that, but Bethany did a wonderful job. The other part is this group has been about inclusion. So to Representative Gelzer's point, at any point, we would invite members from the communities that she talked about and anybody on this panel. For instance, yourself, you had some great questions as a group. You might want to be part of it at some point. But
you tried that.
But this committee is going to be very important to us in forming whatever the placeholder bill may be, in forming the last parts of it and moving it forward in this session. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We'll close the informational hearing, and we are adjourned.